Thank you for joining us. There are 12 of us live in the hall today, but of course most of us are on virtually, as is the mode these days. I was thinking this morning we really in our community have been going quite at a significant pace since we stopped going live in a certain sense and went to the Zoom world. And so I thought there's been much teaching and practice over these past months. And I realized it's been a while since I used to periodically just devote one of these Dharma talks to just answering people's directly questions and answers. So my thought is to do that this morning. And so before I came here this morning, I took a look with Angie these past, probably since March, April, when we went in this direction, just to see some of the offerings. I mean, this is not in terms of our regular offerings, but offered a half day on the four immeasurables. We had 103 people. We offered a weekend retreat on cultivating the fearless mind, 65 people. Unfolding the natural mind, 52 people. Patience and acceptance, 91 people. Taking the self out of the life equation, 66 people. Transforming seeds of suffering, 36 people. And then we've done other types of workshops, classes, inner critic, 56 people. Mindful communication, 31. Wheel of sharp weapons, 72. Self-awareness, self-care, I think there are about 35 or 40. Balance in the digital world, 41. Buddhism, the basics, which was an ongoing weekend class, for 40. So I just did that to sort of prime the pump. So many of you who are listening that right now have been on or participated in those retreats or workshops, classes, as well as we've had ongoing intensives on the Bodhisattva Way and on the Mindful Living Path. That's probably involved 130 or so members. So, and again, there's been weekly talks, etc. So, all wonderful. But of course, the most important thing is, are all these experiences making a difference in our life? And where are we stuck? Where isn't the path of application clear to us? So, again, I think it's wonderful to have a community like we have where there is a buffet, so to speak, of wonderful Dharma offerings. But it's important that we stop periodically and just check in. How are we doing? And so I went through this list just to kind of get people remembering the things they might have participated in, but also, to look into your own life right now, your own practice right now. Meditative practice, life practice, where the rubber hits the road, so to speak. How are we doing? Any questions? So please, in the Zoom, there is a chat function down at the bottom of your screen. And so please, if you have your question, please chat it in, so to speak. And people in the hall also can ask questions, and you'll just ask it out loud, and then I'll repeat it for everybody. So let's just take a moment, kind of just go within, and just ask yourself, do I apply the teachings? Where am I stuck? Where do I get tripped up? Where am I not clear how to apply them? Or I think I'm applying them, and yet I seem to have the same issues, which is probably some of what goes on. So again, I want to, we have about an hour. I really want to have a dialogue with the community. So again, take a moment to reflect and then chat your question in to Angie or in the hall, just bow. So I am ready when you are.
Here is a question. I am new to the Sangha and finding myself stuck in interactions with my household members who aren't on the path. When I am learning to act intentionally and peacefully, but my household members are not on the path, how do we find balance in our relationships and interactions?
Yeah, good question. And I would imagine it's a question not just for beginners or new people new to the community. Because, you know, many of us enter the Dharma, enter the world of practice, when our life is already somewhat formed. Whether we're in our 20s or 30s or 40s or 50s or 60s or 70s, which means it's probably more formed, we have ongoing life. We have ongoing relationships, friends, colleagues, family members, you know. And so often, you know, it is, we're the ones who are taking this step, right? And, yeah. So, you know, that's the way it is. And it's can be interesting because as we change, and often just getting involved in the practice, or a community like this is already indicative that we are changing because we weren't here before. Something is changing within us. And that's true. And what that change is and how it looks is unique to each of us, but that is the condition. And so we may be in the process of changing, and yet the people that we've been associated with up to now may not be. And it's not like they're bad, but they may be beating to a different drum. It could be a drum that we were beating to not that long ago. But here we go. And so this is, this takes some finessing and some acceptance. We can't be dictators. You know, I'm changing. I want to live differently. I have different values. I have different approaches to life. Therefore, I demand that everyone around me follow. if you've tried that one, you know where that one goes. It doesn't go to a good place. And so I think we have to begin with this sense of acceptance and knowing that we're the ones who's changing. And that again, you know, many of those activities that now are ways of being or talking that we're not doing now or trying not to do now, not that long ago we did. And so we have to be humble and understanding. That's our practice. You know, we have to be careful. What's my practice? And many of us define our practice very narrowly. My practice is, meditating, following my breath. No, that's your inner meditative practice. But our real practice is about becoming a certain kind of person. That's my practice. A kinder person, a more understanding person, a more accepting person, a more compassionate person, a happier person. And so when we look at it that way, we realize that often these challenges in people or situations are really opportunities. They stretch us. They're opportunities to widen our capacity to understand and to cultivate. I mean, you know, where else are we going to cultivate patience, understanding, compassion, et cetera, than with people that force us to do that? Because if we don't do that, we suffer and we cause suffering for them. Now, having said that, okay, and though this is, you know, this is not easy, having said that, we are changing. And it could very well be that in our process of changing, we are different or becoming different people. And so therefore, the choices we make about how we live, who we live with, friends, you know, how we spend our time, the kind of speech we're involved in or talk conversations, you know, that's also true. and obviously, if we have the freedom over time to begin to put us in ourselves in an environment that are more nurturing and supportive of who we are becoming, you know, is obviously, you know, on the table for each of us. Again, you know, because the people we're with now or the situations we are, or the way we spend our time or hang out or whatever, was based on how we were when we made all these choices, right? So we have acknowledged that. And so we may change. Now, you know, it depends, you know, it depends on situations. So there's no, I mean, many of us are in situations that are just the way it is, you know, and you know, the change cannot be external, so it has to be internal. Some of us, there's more freedom. So these relationships, these people, you know, we can find, you know, with acceptance and understanding and communication, we can find a middle ground. So there may be people in our life who are going to change with us and be accepting of us. But, you know, so again, it's always different. But if it's really, you know, a very difficult situation where the people are really, you know, marching to a totally different drum and they want to continue marching to that drum, right? Well, then we have to deal with that. But yeah, so it's a point of practice. You know, we cannot control the world. That's a fundamental thing. We cannot control people. And so our practice a lot is, how do I work? You know, I mean, if we look at the world, the bigger world, we go, it's really not the way I'd like it to be, right? But yet this is the way it is, so we need to learn to work with it. And so we may look in our very narrow life, you know, who we live with and our relationships, our families. I mean, many of us don't have the families, you know, that in an ideal world we would have liked to have, or we would like to have right now. And yet they are our family, so there is a connection. And so, you know, unless it's really a totally toxic experience, you know, we want to, you know, find that way of connecting with human beings. And again, I think one of the main ways we connect with human beings is in traditionally in Buddhism, we understand that. We understand that they are the product of their causes and conditions. They do not know better. So we are kind and compassionate, even if we have to make changes, right? We're not angry or we're not dominating. So again, I would say, you know, this is practice. This is real practice because it really brings up a lot of you know, negativity in us and adversity, which means we are suffering. And so we want to transform that suffering. And we do it primarily by changing ourselves. Thank you. Take one, then I'll come back to you. Angie has one. Let me. Yes, Angie.
When you speak to practicing in an intimate relationship, partnership, marriage, at times it seems like beginning anew is the practice of choice, feeling the need for some communication with my partner. At other times, it seems like it's a matter of looking at the action of self in the relationship. Would you offer some guidelines?
Yeah, so that's a very tricky. You know, there's no cookie cutter. So I think what the person is asking, you know, for those who don't know, in our tradition, the Plum Village tradition, there is this wonderful practice of beginning new. I've taught it periodically. It's a very simple kind of ritualistic way of nurturing relationships in a very positive way. As a practical way, it is a very cogent way to deal with conflict. Not just conflict. Which is inevitable in every relationship. People have differences, different views, different ideas about how they want to do things. People have different ideas about needs and wants. And, you know, in the course of relationships, there's misunderstandings. There's hurt feelings. So beginning anew is a wonderful process that we have in our community to continually keep things open, right? Keep things moving. And to deal with conflict. But on the other hand, and it sort of refers to my first question, but how about, aren't we just supposed to, you know, deal with it ourselves? You know, isn't this practice about transforming? So if somebody, if my partner, my partner does what? My partner doesn't speak to me the way I'd like to be spoken to, or speaks to me in a way I'd like not to be spoken to, or hurts my feelings, or it doesn't listen to me, or and vice versa, right? All these things happen. You know, well, from a transformative point of view, isn't that all self, right? So shouldn't I just use that to kind of, look deeply into myself and my lack of understanding, my lack of compassion? I think that's the question, right? Which is which? And to me, it's both, right? And I think this is the wonderful gift of the beginning of new practice. Yes, we are doing the inner work, and that is most important. And oftentimes we get hurt, we get angry, we get this and that, we get irritated, and it's all about self, because the world, the person is not being the person I want them to be, not speaking to me the way I want them to speak to me, not acting toward me the way I want them to act toward me, not responding to me the way I'd like them to respond to me. Sounds familiar. That's the nature of it. So, and that's all about a self, right? That is all these needs and wants and hurts. And okay. So great opportunity to what? To work on self. And that should be our go-to. And yet, as opposed to the ancients who lived in caves, who lived in monasteries, or whatever, we are in the world of relationships. So we interact a lot, right? And our relationships are different than, a bunch of people ending up in a monastery together, right? We have intimate relationships. And why do we come together in relationship? Because we have needs, right? We have wants, right? We have a self that wants things, needs things, whatever. So to me, it's both and. You understand that, yeah, if I was a Buddha, right, I wouldn't have any of these issues at all. But of course, if I was a Buddha, I probably wouldn't be in this relationship. So we have to have some humility, okay? So on the one hand, we aspire to that. On the other hand, we accept that we are in relationship. And therefore, these tools of beginning anew are a wonderful way to create harmony in the relationship, to grow the relationship, right? And so beginning anew is a wonderful thing, I think, for any relationship. I recommend that people do it weekly. Don't just use it when things are going off the rails, because it's very nurturing. You know, you once a week you come together, you acknowledge all positive seeds, you water, you know. And again, oftentimes in relationships we get lazy, right? We don't, you know, we all of a sudden we find ourselves, you know, seeing what's wrong and not seeing what's right. You know, seeing what the other person's not doing as opposed to seeing what all the things the other person is doing, right? So stopping once a week and just kind of nurturing the relationship. The second part of it, of beginning anew, is one acknowledges one's own shortcomings, something we do not like to do. You know, where you say, yeah, this week I could have been more of this or it could have been more of that. And I realized the other day you wanted to talk to me, but I had other things on my mind, you know what I mean? And so it's an opportunity for us to kind of step back and look at our own behavior. And then the third thing is where we actually address where we think the other person, where we feel hurt or, you know, or whatever. So, you know, even though it's a wonderful way of dealing with conflict, I think it's also a wonderful way of just nurturing a relationship, right? So again, it's a both and. I think we can practice very diligently and see our own shortcomings, our own self-centeredness, and that most of the stuff that's upsetting us is coming from a sense of self, at the same time acknowledging, yeah, that's where I'm at. And, you know, I want to build a strong relationship. And again, we have to remember that traditional, you know, it's very recent in human history. You know, traditionally, roles, man, woman, husband, wife, partner, you know, these were very well defined, right? As anybody knows in our society, all definitions are off. Roles are off, right? Everything's off. So, you know, there's a lot more conflict. There's a lot more divisiveness in relationships because it is a new ball game, you know, and we know it's an ever changing ball game. So therefore communication becomes essential where it wasn't before. So this is a question from someone in the hall. So just keep it focused so I can repeat it. So you've been working with your own or with others? Oh, your own. Okay, so you've been working with suffering and compassion. So the question is, person has been working lately, acknowledging their own suffering and learning how to bring compassion to their suffering, and wanted me to just speak about that for a moment. Yeah. We come to practice because of suffering, right? Or you know, right? Now again, sometimes it's you know, a suffering because our life is very difficult and we suffer a lot, right? Or we could have physical things or just relationships. So we come because of suffering. The Buddha began because of suffering. Of course, his suffering was a different kind of suffering. See, so there are all different degrees of suffering. His suffering was, he realized the kind of, even though his life outwardly looked good, it was fundamentally meaningless, you know, because of impermanence and all these things and death and, you know, and everything he's gonna lose. So there are various degrees of suffering. Right, from really difficult suffering, right, that life is really difficult for people, or else life is outwardly okay, but inwardly it's not satisfying. Okay, so suffering has a wide range of meanings, right? And so it is fundamentally because of human suffering, right? And again, we don't just see it in ourselves, right? We begin with we ourselves, but we look around to friends, family, society, and we say, whew, A lot of suffering. Right. Okay. So suffering is acknowledgement, ability to be present to, no longer hide from, no longer denied, no longer throw oneself into all kinds of dysfunctional, maladaptive, addictive kind of behaviors to kind of, you know, not feel it or not have to deal with it, which is really the nature of our society. Yeah, so now you're present to your suffering. I suffer. So compassion is simply the response that acknowledges suffering and wants to help alleviate it. I mean, is that in Buddhism, it's an active thing, right? So it's not as if you have to walk around, you know, I love myself, I love myself, I love myself, I love myself, which some people think. I mean, I'm not. It's compassion means, and it also means for other human beings. You know, I am. It's like empathy in action. It's like the empathy connects to your suffering, connects to the suffering of people around you. You know, you're willing to be present and acknowledge they're not happy. When they're angry, when they're sad, when they're depressed, when they're anxious, when they're worried, when they're jealous, when they're, right? Stressed, they're suffering. Okay? That's the connector. Right? And then part two is there anything I can do to help? Now, obviously, when the suffering that you're getting in touch with is your own, hopefully you realize, yeah, that's my job. I mean, that's my primary job first. I want to help everyone. But, you know, if I'm wounded, you know, my capacity to really be there for others is really compromised, right? So, yeah, so I got to heal myself. I got to first take care of myself. And so, you know, the acknowledgement of your suffering, the willing to be present to your suffering, the willing to look into the cause of your suffering, you know, second noble truth. Yeah. You know, what's causing me to suffer? Not just only my childhood and all that, but like right now. Like, why am I suffering right now? You know, it's a beautiful day. Right? You know, why am I suffering? So we understand why we're suffering. And then obviously the next thing is how can I free myself from my suffering? How can I liberate myself from suffering? Because you don't want to suffer, do you? No, third noble truth is the end of suffering. Yeah, I don't want to suffer. I want to transform. So we you know, have all these various practices or whatever that help us do that. Being stuck in feeling bad. That doesn't help, does it? No, and it feels bad. Yeah, I mean, we want to end suffering. Our own and then the world's, or at least people around us. Okay? Yes.
So there are two very similar questions, and one of them is from someone who may be a bit newer to the practice. Mm-hmm. The other one is from someone who's been with our community for many years, mm-hmm. and is, I would say, a very experienced practitioner. But they're both asking, there's so much Dharma and so many offerings in our community. Mm-hmm. It can be a bit confusing. Mm-hmm. From your perspective, how does one determine what the most important thing is to really focus their attention on?
Yeah, so that's true. And there are some Dharma communities where it's, you know, one practice, a few practices, it's very simple. Right? We're not like that because we're trying to be open and to, you know, we have our three paths. And so we want to nurture many different people at many different levels with many different offerings. We're sort of a fusion restaurant, I guess. We're not like... Fusion, maybe we should have that outside. We're sort of a fusion Buddhism. To be trendy. Yeah, so. You know, it's funny, when I started out in Zen, in the Japanese Zen tradition, everybody almost did the same practice, very simple. You sat, you worked on a koan, first koan, and that's all you did. And all the talks and everything else were really supportive of that. Then I met Thich Nhat Hanh, I got a very more open sense of Zen, as you know, much more creative. And then when I went to India, I entered the Tibetan tradition, which was like the opposite of Zen. Hundreds and hundreds of practices. Everybody's doing something else, you know. And I remember going to my teacher at the time and saying that to him. And he said, it's like this. He said, you need... And again, he was giving me practices to do. So he said, you know, you need to do the practices that transform your mind. This is your daily practice, right? And we would say in our community, what are our practices? Learning to be present to the world around us and the world inside us. You know, that's fundamental, right? Mindfulness. That's why in our meditation, we cultivate mindfulness and concentration, right? We also want to begin to, since we are active in the world, we want to, you know, develop a view, a correct view, so we understand things. So therefore, we learn about basic Buddhist teachings of precious human life and karma, cause and effect, and impermanence, and you know, things like that. So we learn fundamental teachings. So, you know, but what's, you know, and I could go on, but we only have limited time, but what's the end game? The end game is things that nurture my development as a human being. Don't turn us into a factory. We're human beings. And we want to develop ourselves. We want to transform ourselves. So on the one hand, we know what our practice is. But the other hand, I asked my teacher, well, there, you know, on the other hand, he would say, on the other hand, he would say, all Dharma is good Dharma. All Dharma is good Dharma. So he would say to me, yeah, you know what your practice is. But if there's a teacher giving a certain teaching somewhere and you can access it, it's good for you. You know, he said, because you're not just, because it Dharma is nurturing. It's like rain. It's good for you. You know, you're only hearing stuff that's good for you. And secondly, he said, you know, this is a bodhisattva path. So the more Dharma you learn, the wider your capacity to help other people, because you'll know lots of Dharma. It may not be for you, but you'll know about that teaching and you may run into somebody who needs that help. So it's sort of like everything else. It's both and. Right. So again, you know, Dharma is helping us change our minds, opening us up. And sometimes, you know, you're in a class or a workshop retreat. It opens us up. It helps us work on a part of ourselves. You know, I often say to people, it's like playing an instrument. You know, you don't just play one piece. You know, you do your scales, you do your studies, you get the pieces you've been playing, and then you get new pieces, you know, and in a practice session, you may be doing six different things, but that's all you're doing, you see. You're developing your skill, your ability. And yeah, so now again, I mean, obviously for people who are serious about their transformation, that is the role of teachers. That is the role of mentors. You know, that's the individual thing. And I think the, you know, danger these days is most people don't have a teacher or they may have a teacher. Like I run into many people, they say, well, my teacher is Thich Nhat Hanh. Well, that's wonderful. What kind of relationship do you have with him? Well, I never met him. Well, that's not a teacher-student relationship, right? And you know, there's a lot of Dharma available these days where you can go online or you can go to these big retreats, hundreds and hundreds of people, and you know, and you don't really have a relationship with a teacher who knows you. So, you know, in sort of for people who are wanting to go deeper into it, it's good to have a teacher who you go to, right? And who talks to you about your practice and what to practice. Okay. But it's also important that we have self-awareness, you know, like, where am I stuck? Where do I suffer? And which of these teachings that I've got would be most helpful to me now? Yeah, so I used to meet people in the Tibetan tradition. They do all these initiations. And when you go to initiations, there's a piece at the end where you make a commitment to do the practice. And so there are lots of people who run around, take lots of initiations, lots of teachings, and then they're very busy in their practice. Uh-oh, because I got to do this for 5 minutes, and this for 10 minutes, and this for 15 minutes, you know, because I made this commitment, which is that's good. But practice is supposed to be transforming. You know, we have to develop ability.
Politics seem to dominate media and conversations today. I have strong opinions, but don't enjoy aggressive conversations. Do I express them? Do I keep quiet? Do my opinions even matter?
You know, I won't go into it. Actually, I brought it with me, but maybe I'll go into another time. I've connected to an old friend, actually. He became a friend because this was in the 70s. He really was involved with Thich Nhat Hanh. And it was really through him that I was able to connect with Thay at the time. And he's been, he's writing a book now about his experiences, and he's been sending me things as he goes along. And he sent me this thing from a dialogue that Thich Nhat Hanh was having with Dan Berrigan, and Jim Forrest was there. And so this was sort of from the transcript. And there's a thing where they're talking together, Dan Berrigan and Thay, and they're saying, and this is back in the 70s, you know, I guess the Vietnam War, you know, that people, they get all this information. It riles them up, right? And they want to do something. And so what they do is just gather more information. They think the answer is to know everything they can. Read the news, read the news, read the news. And often that is destructive. Or else they want to, you know, do something. To just charge. And Berrigan and Thay talked about underneath the emptiness of people's lives and how they just want to fill it up with stimulation, news, and and this was before the internet, before social media. And so interesting, way back then they were saying one has to be careful what one is nourishing oneself with. And Thay talked about the most important thing for people in relationship to the horrible things that are going on in the world. He used the word, they need to be awake. He said they have to be awake to what's going on within them and around them. That is the first thing. And he talked about, and he was right in the midst of, you know, the whole Vietnam thing, and he was a representative of the Vietnamese peace movement, and, you know, to the West and the whole thing. And he talks about, there are times where I don't listen to the news for months. And then I go back to it and I realize nothing much has changed. And he also says, you know, there are times when I just need to look at the sky and the clouds. And that doesn't mean that I don't care about what's going on in Vietnam. It means I have to keep myself balanced. And I have to nurture myself with wholesome things in life. So when I go into the world of making a difference, I'm good. That's not his word. I'm awake. You know, we have to look at these dialogues. Again, I'm not on Facebook. I don't do any of this stuff. But I listen to people, and it seems like what an exercise in futility. You know, we feel good, or the person who feels good, this is what I believe. And then the other person, which only brings a forth a response, the other person, you know, and then what? What has really happened? Have we done anything that is nurturing transformation, either in myself, the other person, or the world? You know, communication means there's somebody speaking, there's somebody listening, the person who's listening responds, you know what I mean? There's a dialogue. And it precludes that, I mean, it includes this idea that the person I am dialoguing with wants to listen. Right? If the person doesn't want to listen to what you have to say, which means they don't want to understand you, or if you don't want to understand the other person, that's not a dialogue. And we have to be very careful that what passes for dialogue are just people yelling past each other. To me, if somebody has an opposing point of view, my response is not to present my view. My response is to try to understand them. That's our practice. How can a person look at the same facts and come up to such a different conclusion that I came up to? Isn't that curious? Let me see if I can understand that. So now we're modeling something. In that, because of the nature of our social democracy, you know, that we don't take stands or we don't take stands on issues, but it's how do you go about it? And how do you, you know, relate to people who do not see it the way you do? You know, and if I was talking to them, I'd say to them, and how do you relate to people who don't see it the way you do, which happens to be us, you know, the ones who are asking the question. So we have to begin where we're at and really ask ourselves, you know, do I really have any interest in understanding the other person? Do I really want to walk in their shoes? You know, do I want to, you know, deeply understand them, their causes and conditions? Because to be awake is to be awake to what is. And to be awake is to want to understand people's causes and conditions or societal causes and conditions so one can get at the root. With Buddhism, you know, we all have all kinds of ideas about ourselves, about life, about what makes us happy, what makes us suffering, what's a good life, what's a bad life, and yet we're not happy. Right? All kinds of ideas. And so most people just endlessly are manipulating their life. Right? Well, maybe I should take up tennis. Maybe I should take up a hobby. Right? Maybe I should what? Find a new relationship. Maybe I should change. I should, you know, get out more. You know what I mean? We have all kinds of ways of, in a superficial way. But Buddhism says, no, we need to look deeply. Right? What is the cause of my suffering? Is it because I don't have a hobby? Right? You know, especially when people who retire, right, it's like, all right, now maybe that's my problem. Yeah, and people take up a hobby and they may take up a hobby, but that's the problem. Really, it's a deeper problem within people. And so I think it's important that we be willing to be people who look deeply, who are aware. Thank you. Yes.
I feel more challenged now than ever to remain in the present moment when uncertainty is often overwhelming because the stakes seem higher than ever. I'm a planner and can't plan these days. What to do to live in the present more fully?
Yeah, so, I'm not sure that the stakes have not always been high. I think if you look at human history, history of our own country, it was really a time when the stakes weren't high for somebody. Right? I'm just stopping now because I hear my sound. This is green. Okay, so should I turn this off? Just 1 second, we're switching. So where were we? All right, right, right. This takes, so I say, I think that's very subjective. I think if this was 1940, 1938, 1939, if you know what's going on then, I think the stakes were high. I think the stakes were high in the 60s, 70s. I'm not denying with climate change that in a certain way that is true. But again, the stakes have always been high for humanity. But with the COVID and everything, there is an uncertainty. But the uncertainty is a direct it is in opposition to our belief in certainty. The fundamental teaching of Buddhism is impermanence, right? Nothing is certain. Everything is arising because of causes and conditions. When causes and conditions change, situations will change. That is a fundamental ground of our understanding, that the ground we stand on is not permanent. It is subject to causes and conditions. There's no solidity anywhere. So what we're talking about with the COVID is a belief we had that things would just continue, but nothing continues. I mean, work has never continued always the same. Relationships have never continued always the same. Society has never continued. There've always been challenges. This is just, something that's affecting everybody, So it's kind of waking us up, but it's waking us up to a fundamental reality. We were all experts now on epidemics and pandemics and realize, they've been part of human history, for centuries, right? This happens to be ours, right? But they're part of life, and they have these devastating, if you read about the ancient ones, devastating effects on society. Yeah, so Buddhism also teaches, that the future doesn't exist. It's just an idea. So I think that has to be the basis. That's what we talk about view. How do I view this life? Right. So the question is, how do I live a life if I work? How do I plan if I, think I'm going to live forever? How do I plan for my retirement? and yet know that none of it is going to come out the way I'm planning, right? Because there are too many variables, right? On the way to my happy retirement, I may develop cancer. I may get hit by a bus. There are too many, there's so many variables. So I think the key thing is, how do we live in this life where we, both as personal, but also for work, have to make plans, right? And yet know it's just fabricated. It's a better word, maybe. I'm just making a hypothesis about the way things are going to turn out. And how do you know whether a hypothesis is true? You test it, Remember your geometry? You know, we test them before we call them theorems. And the truth is, you know, we don't know, you know. And if life is turning out sort of the way you hypothesized, then you're very fortunate. But that was just only up to this moment. It could change again. So in Buddhism, we understand that, and therefore we are not attached to outcome. Actually, in that dialogue with Dan Berrigan, Tai was saying something really wonderful. He says, because I think Dan was talking about, you know, many people despair, is ever going to change, ever going to get better, humanity, you know, people can get frustrated. All their efforts in the world more or less stays the same. And Tai says, he said something, he said, I believe that no action is wasted. Right? He said, you know, and he used the example of, I think because he was talking with Dan, who was a Jesuit priest, he said, you know, look at Jesus, you know, small group of followers, nailed to the cross, crucified, you know, what, had 12 disciples, and, you know, some of them betrayed him, some of them ran away, you know, I mean, and yet here we are, you know, 2,000 years later, and his teachings, you know, but who would have known that then? Same way with the Buddha. I mean, the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree by himself. Right? There was nobody there with him. It wasn't televised. Right? He wasn't interviewed right afterwards to talk about his great enlightenment, you know. I mean, it was, you know, in northern, it wasn't even India, right? And here it is, you know, 2,600 years later, and here this, you know, look what it's become, you see. And it started with one person's action. So Tai said is, we don't know. Right? We don't know. But yet we have to act always for the highest good and not be attached, whether it that's what he was saying, you know, you may not be getting results now. But that doesn't mean you still don't act in a noble way. So I'll share that. Yes.
I've worked with transforming my to-do list to be a to-be list. Mm-hmm. And yet, I often find myself desiring to get things done, satisfaction in completing tasks, not so aware of just being present in the activity.
Yeah, again, it's both and. Yeah. I mean, you know, when you do the dishes, it's really nice when you get in the end and they're all nicely stacked up and, you know what I mean, that feels good, right? The key is when I'm, you know, let's say you got a pile of dishes, dirty dishes, right? You've used all your dishes, you've used a bunch of pots, you know what I mean? You got it right? Right? And you're going to undertake a process of now cleaning them, right? So eventually they're going to be over here or in the dishwasher, okay? That's the process, right? And yet, the key is, when you're washing the dishes, you're just washing the dishes. You're not looking forward, thinking about, I can't wait till this is over, I can't wait till they're all done. You know what I mean? I'll feel so satisfied when I can see they're all done. Yeah, that's not washing the dishes. Washing the dishes means, you know, this is the result I want, and now I'm just going to participate totally in the process that if I do it, will get me there. I don't, but if I'm thinking about the process or thinking about where it's going to lead me or thinking about I can't wait till it's over so then I can really get on with my life, you know, right? That's not washing the dishes. That's not living in the present moment. The present moment is I'm alive right now. I'm alive to washing the dishes. I'm totally here. I'm alive to their being done. And then I'm alive to whatever happens after doing the dishes that I've planned. You know, it's just, you're putting the same energy, the same awareness into every moment, right? So you're planning something, but as you're doing every moment of whatever you're doing that is bringing you to wherever your outcome is, you're present. That's the practice. And that's very important. I mean, that's the path is the journey, right? I want to get there, but I get there as long as I'm present to each step. As long as I'm present to each step and stay on the path, I will get there. I don't have to think about getting there. I don't have to think about what I'm going to do when I get there. That's this other thing people do. They're always thinking about what's going to happen and how it's going to be. And, you know, it's like, be patient. You know, when you get there, you'll find out. And if you think about it, you're just contaminating that experience. Because you know what? It will never be the way you think it should be. It'll always, because why? Because those are thoughts. Reality is what's happening. Personally, I love reality. Whatever it is, right? Because it's real, it's alive. And if you have no expectations, you're always surprised. See, if you have expectations, then you're disappointed, right? You know, it's not meeting my expectations, right? You see? But if you have no expectations, it's always good. It's like there's a Zen thing which says, you know, in terms of archery, you know, if you don't have a target, Anywhere your arrow lands is a bullseye. I mean, it's really wonderful when you think about that. You know, but if you have a target where they are, then you're either, you know, it's a good shot or a bad shot, right? You know what I mean? It's almost there, but if you're just involved with the whole process of shooting the arrow and the experience of that, then everything is good. So please remember that. If you don't have a bullseye, then every arrow. Now again, I understand before somebody, you know, at work, my boss will not accept that so please use common sense. Okay. Yes.
When I'm in formal meditation practice, I'm aware of distracting thoughts. During the day, I feel pulled to various actions and distractions. I'm confused about how to live my life in ease and freedom for the benefit of all beings.
You just read that one more time. There's a lot in that one.
Yeah, when I'm in formal meditation practice, I'm aware of distracting thoughts. And then when I'm off the cushion during the day, I feel pulled to various actions and distractions. So distracted mind on and off the cushion.
Yes.
I'm confused with all this about how to live my life in ease and freedom for the benefit of all beings.
So I think the problem is in the word distraction. There's no such thing as a distraction, right? I mean, all distraction means is that it's something that's distracting me from what I want to be doing. That's a distraction. It could be anything, right? I mean, if my job is always to look outside, then if that's my job, then looking outside is not a distraction. Looking inside would be a distraction. If my job was to look inside, looking outside would be a distraction. So distraction is always in relationship to something else, right? So when we're in meditation, it's not like thoughts are bad. Thoughts are just thoughts. And actually, some thoughts are quite good. But it's in meditation where my object is to focus, let's say, on my breath, on my body, to be concentrated, then, you know, following thoughts, getting involved in thoughts, you know, thoughts are a distraction, right? If my practice is to watch my thoughts, thoughts aren't a distraction, they're my practice. So it's all in relationship to. Now, so this is important. This is why, you know, every morning, when we do our morning meditation, we end with setting our intentions for the day. So when we have an intention, how we want to be today, what do I want to do today? Then we have a path. Anything that takes us off that is a distraction. Can you see, it's distraction is relative. So if would the person say their object is to be at ease and help sentient beings? Yeah. So anything in the way you're entering the world, spending your time, interacting with other people, you know, that is producing ease of mind and fulfilling, you know, your intention is fine. Anything that takes you away from that or sabotages that, you're distracting from what you've said is your intention in life. So again, it's all in relationship to us, right? How do I want to be today? How do I want to be in relationships? What do I want to be focused on? The same way in sitting meditation, there's a focus. This is what I want to be focused on. Right? There's some meditations where you don't focus on anything. So I think that's very, you know, again, obviously in life, it's more difficult because there's more going on. And there's a lot to pull us away. So we have to be strong. You know, this is my purpose. This is how I want to show up in life. This is how I want to be in life. And so, you know, the clearer that is within us, you know, mindfulness doesn't just mean present. Mindfulness means being present with criteria. I am mindful of what I'm doing, but I'm mindful of it in the context of what I want to be doing or not want to be doing. Wholesome, unwholesome, right? So if I'm mindful in my meditation, I am mindful that I am concentrated on my meditative object, and I am mindful that my mind has gotten distracted, which means it's gone other than where I've set it to go. So mindfulness is that thing on the cushion, and especially during the day, that makes us aware of what we're doing, what we're thinking. Yeah, if all of a sudden you find yourself irritated or angry or something, you know, you go, oh, you're mindful. You realize, oh, anger has arisen in me. I'm cultivating an unwholesome emotion. And yet my intention is not to do that. So therefore I correct. Yes.
Could you please speak about what it means to transcend the cycle of birth and death?
In 2 minutes or less. Yeah, so we could say, you know, this is sort of the deeper end of the pool. Yeah, we want to transcend the cycle of birth and death. Now, what does that mean? That doesn't mean in Zen that we no longer want to be born or die. Transcend means not to be caught in the cycle of birth and death. We are recycling moment to moment. Thoughts arise, thoughts die. Appearance, disappearance, right? So in a certain way, we are participating in the world of birth and death. Feelings arise and disappear. Mind states arise and disappear. Experiences arise and disappear. Birth and death is a process we are participating in always, right? On a moment to moment, day to day, hour to hour, you know, it's a process. And in terms of the life of our body, you see, which is different than our mind, our body also participates in its own birth and its own death, right? So this is what's going on all the time. Transcending birth and death means I am not caught in that cycle. Caught means I'm attached. When I'm attached, I get whirled about, right? So if something is cycling and I'm caught, what happens? I get whirled about. That's what happens when we're caught in the world of birth and death. We don't understand that everything that is born dies. Every moment arises and passes. Every thought arises and passes. Every feeling arises and passes. Every experience arises and passes. Birth and death. To transcend it is to know the impermanent, empty nature of that process. And so therefore we can participate in it, and yet we're not attached to it. We transcend it. In Buddhism, we transcend through our awareness of how things really are. And then we can freely participate in the world of birth and death, because it's not how things really are. So that is certainly our goal. You know, we get off the cycle of birth or death, not by not being born again. We get off the cycle of birth and death because we're no longer propelled because of our attachments and our aversions and our wrong thinking. Anyhow, that's, yeah. So we should probably maybe one more.
Okay, in 2 minutes or less, I've been thinking.
Is this a test today or what?
I've been thinking and trying to understand that we are not separate beings. We are interconnected to everything and everyone around us. Mm-hmm. So if there's no self, if there's no I, who am I? Where and how are we separate, if at all? Can you talk a bit about this?
Well, Buddhism talks a lot about that, and obviously a lot of what we teach here deals with that. But this question, who am I? What am I really? Is the fundamental question that we all have to answer. And that really is what meditation is about. Right? Because before we begin the path, we identify with all kinds of things. One of the biggest identification is with the self. I'm me. I'm Fred. This is where I was born. These are where my parents were. This is what I've done. You know, we have a whole narrative of past. This is my plans. This is my hopes. This is what's going on. This is who I'm related. This is my house. This is my car. This is my, you know, right? But who am I? Who's the one who just said all that? Who's the one who just told that story about Fred? It can't be the story, because there's somebody telling the story, isn't there? There's somebody who's been there throughout the life, and yet somehow is not the life, because it knows the story. Who's the story maker? And so that's what meditation is really about, to learn to look to see, who is that? Right? Thoughts come and go, feelings come and go, relationships come and go, days come and go, moods come and go. And yet there seems to be something, there seems to be a me that's experiencing all that. And yet, what is that? You see? And that really is what meditation's about. And that's really the fundamental question we all have to face. Who am I? You know, that's the Buddha. You know, that's why the Buddha turned to meditation. Is it like, am I just the one who's born here? You know, this is what I do. I'm married. I have a kid. You know, I'm the prince. You know what I mean? I got all the, is this who I am? And yet it all ends. You know, the body dies. I'm going to die. And this whole life is going to totally disappear. There has to be something else. That's what the real spiritual search is about. To find, you know, what's real? In other words, you know, what is reality? Because the reality that we perceive is constantly changing. The reality that we've experienced is just changing moment to moment. But what really is there? What is this? Anyhow. So these are questions that are good, but they should be answered. In the beginning, we do it intellectually. We go into Buddhism, philosophy, psychology. But ultimately in Buddhism, it's not that hard, really. Because who we are is who we are. And all we need to do is turn and look. And that's turning away from all this external identities, these external selves. And really looking at, you know, where it's all coming from. I want to thank you all. This was a lot of fun, and very enjoyable. I must admit, for me, I enjoy the interaction.